Hi, everybody. Welcome back for this week's episode of Unsolicited Feedback. This week, I am joined by our interim co-host, Ravi Mehta, and our old friend, Casey Winters. Casey Winters has been CPO at Eventbrite, ran growth at companies like Pinterest and also Grubhub, and has advised dozens of startups on their growth, marketplace, and product problems. He's recently published a few blog posts that we're going to do for this week's deep dive and that we get into today about second products, but also the difference between taking big swings versus small swings and working on innovative, crazy stuff versus nailing the foundations. That's our part two. So the most recent one has an Outkast quote in it. So why don't you just tell us what the Outkast quote is and why Outkast is in any way relevant to startups and product building?
Sure. So the Outkast quote is, if you ain't got no rims, don't get no wood grain steering wheel for real, which when Big Boy says it, it's a lot cooler than when I say it.
I was hoping you were going to try to do a Big Boy imitation, but you didn't go for it.
There's
an
important reason I will not try that. The song is Aquemini by Outkast, if you're not familiar. And the point of the lyric, which he goes on to expand in the rest of the verse, is get your priorities straight. There's like an order in which you should be trying to make money, secure your family, all these kind of things. And I actually used this quote with a startup I was working with recently. We were talking about some kind of advanced SEO growth stuff we could be doing. But as I started probing more deeply what was currently happening, you know, a lot of the fundamentals on SEO, which are pretty well established around engaging the pages, do you have the right content on it, like your title tags, your internal links, your external links, you know, they just really weren't dialed in. They weren't ranking number one all the time. So when I realized that, I was just like, there is no way we should be talking about this more advanced stuff that Expedia does or whatever. There's a lot of the fundamentals we still need to nail. And I'm sure both of you have had this conversation in some form before with people on your team or companies you've advised, where people just kind of skip over the fundamentals and start trying to do fancier stuff. And the fancier stuff's not really going to pay off a lot of the time if you haven't nailed the fundamentals. This isn't always true, of course. But as this is the type of conversation I've had, anything that I talk about with multiple companies, that's like my excuse to write about it.
I'm curious, what are other examples of the types of things companies should be nailing on fundamentals before they're taking big swings?
I think there's a ton of basic ones that, you know, we've probably seen a bunch of time. It's like a lot of focus on growth hacking before you have good retention, or it's trying to do something more technically interesting as a product than valuable to the customer. You know, the kind of example I threw in there in the post was a lot of people playing around with AI when their core product market fit isn't good, and just launching an AI product's not going to fix the fact that customers don't like you or don't care about you, right? So you're seeing a lot of that in the market. And look, there's reasons to play around with AI. I'm not a hater or anything, but launching some AI feature isn't going to fix broken retention in a core product. Like, you need to figure out why customers aren't resonating with what you're building. So those are like a few archetypes that I think I've seen a lot.
I think it's one of the things that's led to Facebook being successful with its products. Like, people say that, you know, Facebook hasn't had a great track record of launching new products. But if you actually look at the history of products that Facebook has launched, they've launched a lot of them and they've killed a lot of them because they've always prioritized retention over user growth. The thinking being that we know that we can drive users to something. The question is, should we drive users to that thing? And if you can't get engagement and retention really right, then it doesn't make sense to take the scarce resource of where we send users and send them to something that isn't working. And I think a lot of companies do the opposite. They start with, can we drive users to it? And then if we can, let's try to create something that they're going to like and stick to. But at that point, it's probably too late in the process. And so, yeah, I like the idea of thinking about kind of order of operations, especially in terms of getting the fundamentals right and not trying to do too many things at the same time.
The other thing that they've been relentlessly good at is just nailing details, especially on the growth side, right? When you like hear about the types of things Facebook worked on around growth for decades, it was like, make sure it's easy to log in every single country, no matter whether I have an email or a phone or a smartphone or a not phone. It wasn't like, build a new version of Facebook that appeals to this specific demographic that's slightly different. It was nail the basics, nail notifications, nail invites, nail social graph building, nail login, nail reactivation, nail those kinds of things. And just this relentless focus on the whatever they call the blue app now, I think is what they call core Facebook, is just every single detail, getting it right, thing after thing after thing after thing. Now, that's not exactly a luxury that most companies have. Facebook's benefit is the diminishing returns are still massive on like small 0.1% improvement. But it's a good point. Way back when we first started recording this podcast, actually, last time we had Casey on, one of the first episodes, we did this bet that was like, how many MAUs is Threads going to have? And I think my bet, I can't remember if it was 500 million or a billion MAUs, but I was like, it will either have that many or zero. It will either be a product that is going to grow to be a meaningful size that they care about, which is in the many hundreds of millions, or they will shut it down. There's really no in between for them. And I think that's basically your point, Robbie, is this relentless focus on it only matters if it can be meaningful, and we're going to really, really lean into it.
I have a follow-up question on that, Robbie, that may be a little off topic, but you know, you've worked at more teams at scale than I have. You know, primarily, I've worked at startups and you've done both. I've seen examples where a company like Facebook will try to jam it through from a product market fit perspective with enough distribution and enough time. We can kind of force our users to retain our. I think video is like a not recentish example where, you know, the
Threads
initial sentiment.
Threads is a decent example too.
Like, yeah, well, Threads, we're not sure if it's going to work yet. But video, it did work. The initial feedback wasn't super positive. People didn't want that in their feed. People weren't going to the video tab. So the retention, from my understanding, didn't look great. But they just kept grinding, kept jamming it in your face. And now everyone consumes a ton of video on all Facebook properties. So when, as a product leader at scale, like you've done, do you just keep on jamming it through versus do the reassessment that Facebook tends to do every 6 months, every year?
I think with Facebook in particular, they're very good at understanding what are the bets that we're taking that may or may not work out, and what do we have to win? So like if you zoom out, Facebook had to win to some extent in video because that market share, that time share, that attention share was going to go somewhere video centric. It could either go to TikTok, Snap, or YouTube, or it could stay on Facebook. I still think Facebook was a little bit late to the punch with that, but they had no sentimentality. We actually talked a little bit about this last week. I think one of Mark Zuckerberg's gifts is he doesn't have sentimentality about products. He's willing to kill the thing that's not working and move on to the next thing. And within video, there's actually three different products that they have iterated through. They started with Facebook Live, and they were actually an innovator in that space. They got there early, and what they figured out that was, you know, live video is compelling for a certain niche set of users, but it's not the sort of thing that is going to have the mass market appeal that Facebook needs to have in order to support advertising at the scale that they need to. Then they pivoted to compete more directly with Netflix, and they focused on Facebook Watch, which were longer format. They had a bunch of Facebook originals.
I forgot about that.
Celebrity agreements. And that's an area where Facebook retention on video just wasn't great. And then through the process of doing that iteration, they figured out actually the thing where people retain on video is not longer format. It's not highly produced. It's more of sort of in between what your uncle is posting and the really high produced stuff are things that are produced by influencers that have a knack for creating really quick content, the same sort of content that's doing well on TikTok. And so they iterated now with Facebook Watch and Facebook Video and Instagram Reels, both figured out over the long term, like what are the types of video that people are likely to want to consume on Facebook and Instagram and will retain for. So I really think about video in terms of Facebook as three different products. And now they figured out the right product that drives retention for them.
Yeah.
And they weren't sentimental about keeping Watch, even though they had a bunch of agreements. They weren't sentimental about keeping Live, even though they broke new ground there.
What's super interesting here, and I think the framework that I use, and again, I haven't worked at massive scale companies like Facebook, but I think about all product bets on a continuum of, we'll keep doing it if it works on one end, which is like a classic A-B test type thing. And we're working on this until it's provably false, which is like a meaningful all-in bet, if that makes sense. And I like to ask for each of the things that I'm doing, which of these is it? Is it the type of thing where we're going to like, even for things that are small or iterations, for instance, At Slack, we did a big rebuild of our onboarding and activation flow. It was a big redo. We had done a lot of small optimizations. We sort of reached a local maximum on them. They weren't really hitting. We had we talk about this a lot in the product strategy class, a shift in our customer base and the types of people we were reaching. We had to do more there. And at first, it underperforms. And so what do? Do you say, hey, all of that work is not worth it? Let's try something different. Let's just do a whole nother full rebuild. No, you invest in it until it's better, right? If that makes sense. Or it's provably not going to work. Like, we've tried enough stuff that we've run out of ideas. And I like to think about it as two separate categories of bets. You know, redesigns are a good example of this. I think a poor way to do a redesign is ship it as an A/B test. The metrics are worse. Oh no, freak out. We're not going to do the redesign. That's probably the right thing to freak out about. But the answer is, what do we need to do to make this new thing meet this fully optimized old thing that actually doesn't work for us anymore, right? And lean into the new thing. So it's interesting to look at the must win for Facebook. We have to win at Reels. There's no version of the world where we don't have this product, right? Or Stories is probably the same for Instagram, versus the things that are like, this may or may not work, and we're willing to cut bait on it if it doesn't.
And Facebook has been really good about figuring out what are the things that they must win at, with the one exception being Oculus. And I think the reason Oculus has stayed for as long as it has as such a high priority is the company feels like they need to win at whatever is after the phone. And so the best hypothesis is that Oculus VR is after the phone. We didn't win that in the last generation, and Apple and Google won that. We need to win the next generation. And so it's been a very long investment into that, but it just hasn't panned out that platform transition has happened. And yeah. I think now you're starting to see that maybe there's some long-term doubt there, and they're starting to shift focus to AI and other things.
Yeah.
But it's an interesting thing where I think that's exactly right. Like, companies need to decide what's an experiment and what's a bet that they really want to focus on, to build on.
Yeah, the other element of the post, which I'm sure you all have seen as well, is a lot of companies, they do nail the fundamentals, but the fundamentals sort of ebb without people realizing, right? Because you just don't have the good ability to stay on top of them. So one of the things I called out is there's a bunch of operating rituals that, you know, the three of us have, you know, built in our companies to try to make sure, you know, the important things that we got right stay right. And you have the ability to go audit them just to make sure they all still look good, or you have the metrics that keep them top of mind. And I think a lot of times with startups that are still building kind of their operating rhythms, they might have, oh, that thing was working. What happened? It's like, well, yeah, like, you're not paying attention to things. Things will break. They will, you know, get a little bit less optimized than you think. And so it's important to build that ability to track the things you thought you've already solved or staying solved. And if you can't stay on top of that, then it's also a reason that you shouldn't be starting to do some of this more fancy, innovative stuff, because you don't have a scalable way to keep, you know, the fundamentals in the right spot.
Yeah, there's this fantasy that, like, once software is built, it works, and it's a 24% activation rate, and it's going to stay that way unless we go screw it up and
it
do something.
It won't ever require any engineering maintenance at all.
But I think products are like houses, right? If you don't live in a house, we've all seen this in our neighborhoods probably, and no one takes care of it, and you don't cut the grass, and you don't touch anything, it starts to rot and decay. But I think there's another foundational thing, which is that if you're growing, your user base is changing. So the foundation on which your house is built is actually like a flowing lava pit, not a solid bedrock of like people who are all the same, who come in and do the same things, right? And this has been an example at every single company I've worked at. All of a sudden, you tried an experiment 3 years ago. It definitely didn't work. It performed worse. And then you try it again 3 years later and it's better. How could that possibly be?
Yeah.
Right. In a static system, that should never happen. But it's not a static system. The world is changing around you. So what was worse for early adopters might be better for late adopters, is the like classic example, or things that are better in one country are worse in another. And you're dealing with averages. So it's really hard to know which one's the globally optimal. And you could personalize, but then you've created more houses that each need to be taken care of. And so you've created complexity and all those things. But yeah. So we started this at like the fundamentals. I think Ben Horowitz calls them lead bullets versus silver bullets types of product strategy questions. And your blog post was sort of about growth stuff, but I think this is true for all kinds of product things. Why do you think teams gravitate towards silver bullet type things at times? What's the energy that pulls people there that makes that the first set of ideas?
I mean, I think there's a lot of different reasons and different at different levels of the organization, you know, founder versus product manager versus designer. I think fundamentally, people who are ambitious want to work on the most cutting edge stuff. And the reality is most of our job in product is not working on cutting edge stuff, right? There are times where we may get to do that. Like we had a question on our engagement survey at Eventbrite. You know, so we send this survey to all of, you know, our employees, and then we all look at feedback and see if there are things as leaders we could be doing better across the company and in our specific works, right? And one of the questions was like about innovation at event, and we'd score low on it. And then the people would write in the comments on my team, I marked this low, but we're supposed to be low. Innovation's not our strategy right now. We're about fixing technical debt and you know, doing the things our customers need. And I'm like, fuck yeah, that's exactly what's right. But you know, that's not going to excite certain archetypes of designers, product managers, engineers, right? If they can't work on the cutting edge stuff, they get very bored. So I think that's a big thing. Also, if you pay attention to the tech press, your assumption is other companies around you are being a lot more innovative than they are. So you feel like if you're not working on that, you're falling behind not only as a company, but compared to your peers in the ecosystem as product manager, designer, engineer, whatever, which we all know not to be true. But I think that that's a thing. There's also what the culture of the company rewards. And if you're allowed to get on stage and talk about the whiz bang thing and versus the person who gets a 20% win in activation rate no one ever talks about, then you're going to go up on stage and show the whiz bang thing because that's how people are largely motivated unless you're a weirdo like me. So there's lots of things like that that drive people in sometimes these inaccurate directions of what creates the most value at the company. And there are different cultural styles that can get further or closer to the optimal, right? There's results-oriented cultures, like Robbie was talking about with Facebook, right? Where this maybe is less of an issue day-to-day because if it doesn't create impact, you're not going to get promoted or any of that kind of stuff. And then there are other cultures where that might get you more promotion, visibility than doing something that actually moves the business metrics.
Yeah, I think like all things, it kind of comes back to incentives, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think another thing here is that people often conflate if the question is hard, then the answer must be hard. And so if we have a hard question, like how do we grow? It begs for a hard answer. Like we need to do the really sophisticated thing. We need the silver bullet, not the lead bullet. And so really smart teams that I think are very good at decision making in a lot of circumstances when it comes to figuring out what to prioritize often gravitate towards the complicated solution rather than the solution that is simple and obvious and requires the really important deep work that will give you the long-term results versus the thing that feels like the magic bullet.
Right. You know, when we had Nabil Hayat on, who's a VC at Spark Capital, about a couple of months ago, we talked a little bit about this 2x2 of risk versus impact, and that obviously you want to do all the low risk, high impact things, but over time those should disappear. And what companies tend to do is they go to the low risk but low impact stuff because it's easy to do. It's low risk, it's high win rates, but really you should be going to high risk. But what this conversation is leading me to is that there's a conflation of risk and novelty, if that makes sense, that happens in people's minds where they think that if something is like shiny, new, crazy, never been done before, it must be high impact. But it turns out like most of those things, even if you like thought through what is the highest possible impact of them, tend to be small versus, hey, let's fix the 45 known issues.
We used to stream the Apple Worldwide Developer Conference, and they would always launch some whiz bang new feature on iOS, and we'd have a bunch of engineers that would go race to figure out what to do and launch it, and none of those things ever mattered, right? But we thought, oh, we got to be first, do 3D touch or whatever, and it's just like there are only a few of those technologies that are really game changing over the course of like a many decades career.
Yeah,
and yeah, if you're always paying attention to all of them, trying to do all of them, you're gonna waste your time most of the time.
Yeah, and honestly, let's just look at Apple. Most of the things are kind of like the next obvious step on things. They have some whiz-bangy things that are like big deals, but a lot of stuff just feels like the next obvious move, and they're kind of masters at it. Like, they're really polished. They're really well done. There's tons of lead bullets. But one of the criticisms of Apple is that they don't innovate. But in a lot of ways, Vision Pro aside for a second, a lot of what Apple's innovation is so good at is one foot in front of the other product improvement over the course of decades across many, many dimensions, right?
They have an MVP style of framework that works for them. It's obviously an incredible level of polish, but they get things proved in the market. then they iterate on further when you think about using the thumb and then that, how that transforms into payments and then how that transforms into face, right?
Like, yes.
They actually are very deliberate in how they do it. Slower cycles for hardware, of course, than for software. And hardware means higher quality bar for the launch of something. But I think, yes, they're very deliberate and good at what they do there for sure. And people miss the point.
And sequencing, that like it always looks like they haven't taken big swings. But when you, not to use a Steve Jobsism, to connect the dots backwards, you're like, wow, Apple Pay is a huge deal. Huge deal. Doesn't look like a big deal because it was like, yeah, from thumb to face to tap to Apple Card. Like there are all these little layers that eventually ended up with, oh, you're tapping your phone to buy things everywhere you go all the time, and peer-to-peer payments and everything else all just kind of comes together, right? Apple Pay, the peer-to-peer cash sending thing, doesn't work unless you can use that money at a terminal with your phone to buy real things, right? Otherwise, it's just fake internet currency, right? They require that kind of, we're working on this until it's provably false type mindset, right? Because the next thing and the next thing and the next thing all rely on it. And like, I think there is a style of roadmap that I see a lot that's like, we're going to do obvious stuff and then we're going to do weirder and weirder and more vague things over time. You know, you guys know what I'm talking about. Like every team has them. It's like quarter one is like the obvious things. Quarter two is the next obvious thing. And quarters three and four are like magic AI things or like crazy stuff that we've never thought. Personalization is the most common one in activation, onboarding, and like checkout type stuff. It's always Q4, right? It's always four quarters out from now. That's not a proper sequenced series of like innovations that layer upon each other. It's sort of, we're doing the obvious stuff now and the crazy stuff later. And then it turns out one quarter later, there's some obvious stuff you have to do now and the crazy stuff is always later, you know? And so the question I always ask is, okay, if you are going to do that thing, what do you need to be working on right now to allow that thing to not be as crazy and always three quarters out later? There's probably something, some ground framework you need to be building or some small innovation you can do. And it ends up looking like a series of lead bullets, even when you do silver bullet things, is sort of a secret, I think, that's here. The shiny thing doesn't look that shiny because it's the obvious next step. So this kind of leads into the other blog post you wrote recently, which is my second product failing? You want to just run down your thoughts on second product development? Because I think companies are doing this earlier and earlier in their life cycles. I think people have realized that you need to have second acts to be long-term successful, but nobody's very good at figuring out if they're working or not.
Yeah, so I did write a series of posts around how to think through S-curves and when a new product is required to hit next S-curve of growth, which a lot of my clients and previous companies have struggled with, you know, thinking through. And one of the things I said in that post, it's like the number of single product IPOs has dramatically declined over the last decade, is that when you're working on a second product, the framework of product market fit, as we know from various VC bloggers or Eric Ries or whatever, doesn't really cover what a team actually needs to do to be successful when you're building on top of something that already works. So I touched on that a little bit in one of my previous posts, which is, look, a lot of times you can run through the product market fit process and then you end up with a product that is a smaller TAM with a slower growth rate than your core business. Congratulations, you fundamentally wasted a large part of the organization's time, because in order for a second product to matter, it has to inflect the growth rate of the combined company at some point in the future, right? Hopefully a measurable point in the future, right? So I kind of cover that a little bit, but then I think it left a poor taste in my mouth and some of my readers' mouth of, well, if product market fit's like not my framework, then how do I know if I'm winning? How do I know if I'm losing? And without going into a bunch of quantitative growth modeling, that can be hard to describe in a blog post. So what I tried to do with this follow-up is basically say, hey, here are a few failure modes you need to watch out for. Because when you're investing in a new product, then you're investing in a new rhythm compared to the majority of the company that's working on optimizing the product that already has product market fit. So OKRs don't really work really well. The timelines on which you measure things don't really work really well. And you got to find a way through that operationally. And we have a few different approaches for that. But then let's say you get through that. You know, you do what Fareed is talking about. You're setting the milestones, the big bet that sounds crazy, start to feel more and more logically on its way by breaking down the assumptions you have to prove or disprove and all of that of this new product you're working through. And you're also setting up the concept of what is the pot of gold at the end of this? Is it a big enough pot of gold that's not going to take too long to get to? And then you have to start assessing as a team, are we still on the path to the pot of gold? Are we lost? Is that pot of gold as big as I thought it was now that I have more line of sight into it? So that's the concept and the analogy, you know, I frequently use is there's a rainbow to the pot of gold. We know it's over there somewhere. We kind of have a rough map of how to get there. We're going to start going that direction, and then we're going to figure out a faster path over time, hopefully. So some ways where that fails is you kind of veer off the path of what we thought the pot of gold looked like. And now you're tackling something that's smaller or doesn't attack the big existential risk of the company. Like Robbie was mentioning, if all video consumption goes off of Facebook properties, Facebook's in big trouble as like an advertising based business. I think that's like a great example, right? Or as you get into building towards the pot of gold, it just seems to be getting further and further away, right? That's something I think we've all seen. Or as you're iterating, all you're learning is the stuff you're doing isn't working, but you're not creating the feedback loop that says, well, now that I disproved that, it now means this thing is more likely to be true. Because you're going to fail a lot in building new products. And that's okay, as long as the feedback loop of the failures is getting you closer and closer to the right idea. But when all the feedback loop is giving you is more things that don't work, you're fundamentally on a path where like you need to reassess like this investment, right? So the idea is to try to say, hey, be aware of these modes as you're entering this kind of territory, because there isn't a lot of documentation of what it even takes to build new products inside a successful product company. And if destination just keeps getting further away, or I've now lost sight of where the destination is, which is the Soundgarden quote. So quick aside, it turns out quoting rap lyrics does way better than quoting alternative rock lyrics. If you're writing feature content yourself, just be aware.
You know they play Soundgarden on the classic rock station now, Casey. They're the Rolling Stones of our generation.
Yeah, I know. I know. It's a boomer moment. But you know, one of the things I put in there is the concept from Soundgarden, which tend to happen at bigger companies where Chris Cornell calls it an attractively packaged bad idea. And a lot of times our idea for second products is something that sounds great, but really it's just a bad idea. And a team has to learn if that's actually what they're doing. And the way you learn that is you're like, there's no destination that you thought was there. Or if we get there, it doesn't help us. It's really low retention, doesn't help acquisition, whatever. So the thing that prompted me to write the post was I was working with a company and they had veered off track to a new destination, which I thought was less attractive than the initial investment. So I had to talk to the product manager and say like, hey, these were all the reasons we decided to fund this project. You're now over here not solving any of these reasons. And you're in this like product market fit maze, like Eric Ries lead startup thing. Like this is not what we're not doing this. We are getting back to this lineup or we're going away. And you're in a situation where the product manager basically did nothing wrong based on the product manager principles that are out there.
They made a set of really good, well-intentioned decisions to make the thing they were working on the most successful and solve a customer problem as successfully as possible. But what it did is it veered off course slowly, I think is the way you're describing it. It's like we went where the customer heat was, but where it took us has nothing to do with the company strategy line anymore.
So
we're like off in the West Pacific instead of wherever we're supposed to be. It's super interesting. And a lot of leads startup methodology. And I don't think it's wrong. It leads you to that, right? Get out of the building, spend time with customers, focus on their needs. There's an iteration of that has to happen when you're like in an existing successful org that is like, are all these things aligned? That is like a really hard secondary problem for product market fit expansion versus product market fit.
Yeah. So you just see a lot of the companies really struggle with this, right? And they don't get that second product right or that third product right. And they're not really building the operating rhythms to know how to do this process better. Obviously, we've talked about some companies that have gotten really good at doing this, sometimes just by happenstance, or sometimes they have 10 failures for every one that hits, but they're big enough that, you know, that math works out for them. Yeah. But I think my goal as a product leader and advisor to make this a little bit more well understood of like, how do we make this most likely to work instead of just throwing stuff on the wall? So I've kind of written this series of posts on second products to try to illuminate some of these issues.
I think one of the problems here is that companies tend to treat the risk profile of optimizing their first product the same as optimizing or building their second product. And so they think, let's just get one second product ideation / discovery thread into market and we'll see how that does. But instead, like the risk profile on those second products is so high because you don't know what's going to have product market fit. It pays to take a portfolio-based approach where you've got multiple different bets that you're running at the same time, so that it doesn't come down to, are we killing this second product? And then all of a sudden our dreams of expanding our product market fit no longer make any sense. And instead is about which of these four or five bets that we made are actually the ones that are panning out. And so where do we want to double down resources and where do we want to cut? And oftentimes companies don't think about it in terms of a portfolio. A VC would never make one bet. If they had one company that did really well, they wouldn't say, okay, what's the next company that I want to invest in? They're going to invest in a portfolio of different bets. And I think similarly, companies that are looking to figure out what is the second product that's going to have product market fit need to take a similar approach.
I'm going to push back on that a little. And only because I think that's true as you get bigger, right? Because the fog of war you're entering is more uncertain. But my bet is, and this is where I'd love to brainstorm examples here with you guys. We can talk about some different companies. Is that great second products in the realm of what we were talking about before are hopefully obvious from a customer problem perspective, market size and expansion perspective, at least early. And while there might be a portfolio in terms of what the exact approach is to the problem solving, my hope would be that it's rough. I don't know. I don't know if most startups can afford to build four side projects and see which one sticks. Let's just think about this. Who are the best multi-product startups, the ones that feel like juggernauts on this?
So I think where Ravi's coming from is a little bit more consumer land approach, because new product development is so hard. And whereas in some of these other models, we do a bunch of research to get an insane amount of confidence that we're going to nail that thing. Whereas a consumer, you put stuff out there and you see a little bit more, because it's not like consumers going to tell you anything interesting if you do the research with them anyway.
It's fair.
Right? Like they're going to be so off. Whereas in fintech or B2B, if you're launching that second product, the expectation that it's going to find product market fit, it should be like 80%, right? Where it's probably like 10, 20% in consumer. So I think there are extremes on this, but I'm a little bit more in the camp for Reed on this point, which is until you get very large, you have so few resources, more work up front, thinking about how your S-curve sequence and what really you need to attack for that second business is important, and something I try to shepherd the founders I work with toward, and then make it a little bit more founder-led as well. And I'm like, look, get your core business something that can run without you so that you can go actually replicate the thing that you did when no one else was here. Just find like the second product that is going to crush. It doesn't obviously need to be the founder. But I think in consumer, it's more likely that you're going to place a few bets and see what gets traction and then throw fire on it. Whereas in even fintech broadly, but consumer fintech, it's more obvious the next thing I have to build, it has to improve my margin. It has to cross-sell to my existing customers. And there's just a set of things that's obviously going to be. And B2B SaaS tends to be kind of the same.
I'm going to go up market. I'm going to go to the next adjacency, et cetera.
Yeah.
So I'll throw out an exception that I think I'm going to argue with myself here, Ravi, and agree with you now, which is I do think there's a class of second product building. Okay. I'm Figma. I have this like juggernaut of an awesome core product that is really strong product market fit. Obviously, we haven't gotten anywhere near the total TAM of it, right? It's accelerating growth. Let's build another thing to drive compounding, right? There's that version of second product. That's obviously the one you want to be. Stripe has released like 30 new products over the course of the past decade, and they're all layered on top of each other based on this core that prints money, right? I don't know if it prints contribution margin, that's the conversation for another day, but literally transacts money, right? There's another version that I think is a lot harder and maybe more common for most of the people, I mean, honestly, in my lifetime and my product work, but also for the people listening, which is our first product is good and working, but kind of like not enough to be everything we need it to be to fulfill expectations, to drive long-term growth. And so you're playing in the what's the next act, maybe in hopes of replacing the original business, which is almost like the pivot version. But the, hey, if like 1+1=3 type product expansion type work, that I think is a lot harder and maybe lends itself to the portfolio approach more, because like there you got to find things, right? Versus, oh, I already have something and I'm going to tack this thing on that makes it twice as good, you know?
if you're a startup that's in that situation where the core business isn't quite working and you need to figure out what the second business is, I think to go back to the beginning, you're in the position of trying to go for the wood grain steering wheel when you don't have REMS. If your business is not big enough to allow you to make multiple bets in order to figure out what's next, I think you're in a really difficult position because you've got to essentially not find a second business. You've got to find a first business by pivoting out.
Well, let's think about Ravi.
First business.
I think where Fareed was going is like the first business is good, but not big enough to IPO.
Yeah.
So you need kind of a second product to expand revenue, expand TAM, whatever, to get you to be an IPO level company, which let's just say is $1 billion valuation or higher, right? That core business is something you definitely don't want to lose. It works. Well, it's going to cap out at $80 million in revenue or whatever, or $150 or something. You see, it's a consumer subscription, right? Like they can cap pretty hard. So I think there is a, how can I predict when it's going to asymptote?
Yeah.
Which means how much time do I have to figure out another product that could be growing the overall business by the time that's going to asymptote? And very few companies do this well. I think in a previous podcast, we talked about HubSpot being one that's absolutely nailed this problem. Mm-hmm. That's where I think you're going to need a pretty concrete bet on what that is and the fact that it could be big enough to eventually take on the burden of growth for the combined business. And maybe that means at the very early part of the cycle, you're running a bunch of experiments. But before the thing, you start actually noticing the hard asymptote, you've picked the one thing and you're going all in.
Yeah. I mean, I think consumer subscription is a good example. A lot of these layer on B2B businesses, right? That eventually become bigger than the original consumer business, right? And I think that's the kind of, I guess it's still a really strong engine and that's what's fueling it. I just think that's the more common case. I need this thing to be like really good, not just like, it's not known problem, known solution type work. It's we have to figure out which of the problems is big enough to be meaningful, which I think is just really hard.
I think there's a couple of distinctions that can be really important here. So the first one is if you are a B2C business and you're taking your product and you are now selling it B2B, I think of that more as channel expansion than necessarily a new product. It might be a second line of business, but it's not necessarily a new product. I think in terms of how you think about your product, there's really three models, I think, for businesses. You could have a business that's a product. So Facebook is a business that's a product. You could have a business that's a portfolio where actually no one business is enough to sustain an organization of a size that can be IPO'd. And if that's the case, then it's really not about what's your second business. It's about what is your second, third, fourth, and fifth business that we need in order to build out our portfolio. And I think a really good example there is Roe and Hims started by creating a business around erectile dysfunction drugs. And today they have a portfolio of businesses around hair loss and skincare and other types of healthcare needs. And so they were able to find there's this one particular product that works, but it's not enough on its own. And so we need to take more of a portfolio approach to our business.
Good example.
I think Match is also in that example with Tinder, Hinge, OkCupid, Plenty of Fish, Pairs. That's a portfolio of business. No one dating app, even though Tinder's gotten pretty big, is enough to sustain a company on its own. And so we need to proactively build a portfolio. And then the third type is a business that's a platform. And in that way, you have additional product lines that get added onto your platform. And I would argue that Stripe is in the platform bucket where they've been able to add so many different services because they've created a fundamental payments platform that you can then slot things into. So I think part of this question is, are you a product business, a portfolio business, or a platform business? And then from there, you can start to figure out, well, what does it look like if we go and expand that?
I love that. I think that's a great segue to the topic that I think is like adjacent to this, which is organizational structures around these different kinds of businesses. So Square recently announced, throwing some recent news, that they're moving from like a GM type product unit, business unit type organization, where each product is its own like mini company within Square, to a more traditional functional organization, product, marketing, engineering, et cetera, as separate orgs. And what I think is really interesting is, in my mind, most great multi-product companies are, at least in the early days, business unit organized, right? Because these individual groups, of course, they have to stay aligned to company strategy. It becomes a CEO, CPO, et cetera's job to make sure all of the pieces are fitting together and not as Casey describes, veering off into the wilderness where it no longer supports the core business. But each unit needs enough independence to be able to solve the specific problems of their specific customers really, really well. And my understanding is that Stripe, at least at some point, was organized this way. Square has been organized this way. I think HubSpot organizes somewhat this way. I know Salesforce absolutely does, et cetera, almost has different CEOs for these different businesses to this more like functional org. And I think it's really interesting that Square has made that shift now. I wonder if that's a realization that the suite is now what they sell, not a series of different products to SMBs independently. And whether it was starting to pull apart where things didn't work together well. I don't know what the reasoning behind it was, but I thought it was a kind of interesting announcement. I'm curious if y'all have any thoughts on the org structure thing. Because I don't see how you build a 12, 14, 20 product company without some ownership of individual business units being part of it. Although Apple is the obvious, like, massive exception to this.
It's funny. I actually talked with Square about org structure when I was CPO at Eventbrite. I got a lot of good ideas from them. And I think the main thing that they taught me is, okay, so they're a big believer in Conway's Law, which is, you know, kind of like you're going to ship your org chart naturally. So no matter which org structure you choose, it's about how you mitigate the downstream effects of that. So it's almost less about whether you're a GM structure or whether you're a functional structure, and more, what are all the other operating principles you create in that structure that make those seams of the org structure less painful to the customer? And they have a particular set of things they do at Square. I think Sawmill, who is one of these GMs, I think he has a podcast on In-Depth from First Round that where he goes into this, which is, I would urge you to listen to. It's pretty good. But so part of what this makes me think is, okay, well, Eventbrite had a GM structure when I started, and it was, or shortly before I started when I was advising, and it was working pretty terribly because Eventbrite is a giant network business. So you have a really faux independence of these business units, because the reality is they have to rely on everyone incredibly dramatically to get anything done. So you can't really have clean P&Ls anyway. You don't get really any of the benefits. So we switched back to functional and have stayed that way for 5 years now. So why would, after 8 years, Square decide to make this shift? Well, one of the things that, you know, Jack said in that letter to his shareholders is that he wants Square to be a leader in engineering and design again, a team people point to as inspiration and aspiration to join. And one of the things you do lose with a GM structure is the GM becomes more general business leader that has functional people report in from product, from engineering, from design, from marketing, et cetera. Yeah. And most of those, maybe some of those people aspire to be a GM, but a lot of those people are actually aspiring to be better in their specific field, and they're reporting to a generalist. Now, in Square's case, most of those GMs are engineering backgrounds.
Oh, interesting.
I believe but the majority of them are, which I think is pretty good for such a technology-focused company. So that's what Jack's pointing to. But there's another thing that came to mind as I was thinking through this, which is, so Square historically built a point-of-sale product that had incredible product-market fit. And to our previous conversation, they expanded primarily by offering their small businesses incremental products that they had very high conviction were going to help those small businesses, things like loans, marketing tools, et cetera. And yep, all of those had their own GMs. But the biggest product innovation was Cash App. And Cash App also has had a GM up until recently that ran completely independent from the Square ecosystem. And I think part of the reason they did that for such a long time is some of their early efforts to bring the consumer into the Square ecosystem just failed miserably. Like, they realized they didn't understand consumers, and just the fact that they had cool small businesses didn't bring consumers in as a value prop. So instead, they built a separate consumer product building on their fintech expertise. And now they might be saying, Cash App is big enough that I want to integrate it back into the small business ecosystem I built. And having two GMs that don't even talk to each other that much, it's not a great way to do that. That's not, you know, what Jack mentioned, but I thought underneath might be another reason that they're deciding to make this change now, because feels like it's been very stable, you know, business unit structure. I don't know, Robbie, what you think?
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting example. As you went through things, I think there's a question at the CEO level of, are you managing one thing or are you managing many things? And if you're managing many things, then a GM structure really works. You want to have different GMs that are managing those businesses that are essentially CEOs of those businesses, can operate independently, autonomously, and really quickly to grow those businesses to their maximum value without anything getting in their way. But if instead you're building one thing, then you want to have the CEO be the point of interaction and collaboration across all of the different parts of the business. And I think Apple's a really good example of, they do many things, but it really ladders up to one thing. They have an incredibly broad and powerful ecosystem of devices and software, all of which have high interoperability, all of which work together pretty flawlessly and enable you to buy into that ecosystem rather than buy a watch or buy a phone or buy something else. And so there, I think they've been able to scale more than any other company the functional model, because they've never gotten away from the ecosystem being the thing. Whereas like at Amazon, each one of their different businesses is pretty different. And if they don't interoperate really well, if they don't look really similar, if someone can't get up and running in one product and already be up and running in the other product, that's okay, as long as the GMs of those businesses have the ability to grow them to their maximum extent. And I think what might be happening at Square is, 8 years ago, they thought, okay, we're going to be managing many different things. We're going to be managing not only our point of sale product, but also ancillary products that meet different needs of small business owners. And now with the success of Cash App, it's looking like ultimately they're really managing one thing. They're managing a payments platform and ecosystem, with Cash App forming a really fundamental part of that. And where, in order to create the sort of cross-product connections that they want to create, it doesn't make sense to have a GM structure anymore. It makes sense to have Jack be the one who's integrating across all of those different functional areas.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things that doesn't get talked about enough with org design is there's no right org model. It's just a matter of trade-offs. And the most fundamental sort of first principle trade-off has to do with, what do you want to make people accountable for, and where do you want people to collaborate? And when you have GMs, you have accountability around lines of businesses. When you have functional groups, you have accountability around the craft and the quality of that particular function. And that was something that Jack hit in the note that he sent out.
Yeah, having worked in both forums, the other thing that I think happens, you know, at Zynga, we had a GM model. Makes a ton of sense. Every game is its own business. Yep. There are some common platform, common things, data and analytics, engineering platform, infrastructure, and also shared learnings, right? Because different teams were doing different things. But it makes sense for a game to be a business, right? Like, are you spending enough on R&D? Are you spending too much on R&D? Are you spending enough on marketing? Not enough on marketing, et cetera, even if the services were somewhat centralized. But what was harder was, how do we do engineering at Zynga? How do we do product at Zynga? And it required a lot of like cross connection. So we ended up with a team called Central PM, which is like a product management group whose job it is to manage product management across the whole org, which would make no sense in a like normal functional organization, right? But makes a lot of sense in that kind of org. Their job was figure out what's working across the whole network, identify best practices, make sure things are being shared. They were basically like the craft portion of PM, you know, plus some data and analysis and that kind of thing. So what's interesting is both orgs end up converging on, there's a matrix structure to everything. There's either like at Slack, I was like ostensibly not called GM, but responsible for the self-service business, but I was in the product team. And so I had to go wrangle a bunch of things across a bunch of different orgs to get things done, but it was a functional organization. So you end up with this like matrixy sort of thing around certain business initiatives or business units, right? But in a functional org, you end up with like quasi GMs. And in a business unit org, you end up with these like shadow functional organizations across them that are like, how do we do hiring for engineering so that it's consistent across the whole org, even though the GMs are making the hiring decisions instead of the, you know, CTO. So they both end up converging. It's sort of like, what's first priority, what's second priority in terms of the org? I just thought this one was really interesting and somewhat surprising, honestly, especially because of how it, on the surface, they look different. But honestly, like looking back at it, we've called it Square this whole time, but they basically telegraphed this when they renamed the company Block. This isn't Square, the company. This is like a bigger thing that has multiple things and we have to care about all
of them. In fact, Alyssa, the GM of Square, is called the CEO of Square. Yeah, that's what her title has been, I think, for the last couple of years. So yes, they're...
Either that or Jack just wants to be like Steve Jobs. I don't know. It's one or the other.
Yeah, you know, he's Jack Dorsey. It's hard to tell exactly what's going on there. The guy likes Bitcoin a lot. But yeah, it's very interesting and something that a lot of people have to deal with. And yeah, you're right. There's no perfect structure. It's interesting to see at the scale they're at. I think he said 12,000. We're under 12,000 people cap, which apparently was some goal they were trying to get to. So this is a pretty massive scale to be making such a massive shift in org structure company-wide.
Tech CEOs used to brag about how big their companies are, and now they're bragging about how small they are.
It's kind of cool.
Yeah.
But it does remind me of a joke that I once heard when I took a new job. It was like, you know, old CEO has been replaced by a new CEO. Old CEO hands the new CEO three envelopes. He says, every time you have a problem, open one of the envelopes. And they're numbered, 1, 2, and 3. And so year passes, CEO opens the first envelope. He's got a problem. It says reorg. So he like does his reorg. Everything's fine. They move on. Second one is blame me. So it's like blame the previous CEO, moves on, gets to the third crisis, opens the third envelope. It says go get three envelopes. So, you know, we're on envelope 2.
Peace.
Thanks for joining us this week. Stay tuned for next week's episode with a new interim co-host, Joff Redfern from Menlo Ventures, as well as our guest, Sean Close.